Today is Sunday, April 7th, 2024. I'm going to begin this Taisho by going back to an article I read a little bit from during an encouragement talk, either this Tuesday or last Tuesday, sometime recently. And it was published in the New York Times. The author is Melissa Kirsch, and the title is Why We Can't Stop Rushing. And here's what she says. We rush because we're late. We also rush because we want to move quickly away from discomfort. We rush to come up with solutions to problems that would benefit from more sustained consideration. We rush into obligations or decisions or relationships because we want things settled. Want things resolved. Come face to face with that in Zazen. Working on a koan, any practice really. Want to be doing it right. We want to be done with it. That's not going to happen. She goes on, worrying is a kind of rushing. It's uncomfortable to sit in a state of uncertainty, so we fast forward the tape, accelerating our lives past the present moment into fearsome imagined scenarios. This obsession with being done with things, living life like an endless to-do list, is ridiculous. I find myself sometimes having a lovely time, out to dinner with friends, say, and I'll notice an insistent hankering for the dinner to be over. Why? So I can get to the next thing. Who cares what the next thing is? Just keep going. Keep rushing, even through the good parts. In Marie Howe's poem, Hurry, she describes running errands with a child in tow. Hurry up, honey, I say. Hurry, she urges, as the little one scampers to keep up. Then she wonders, where do I want her to hurry to? To her grave? To mine? Or one day she might stand all grown? Well, the lesson is pretty clear. Because of our compulsive movement from this moment to the next thing, we miss our lives. Kids grow up before we know it. Our puppies become dogs. We become old. Why are we in such a hurry? Everything we need is right here. That's what I'm going to be talking about today. Hagwon says, like one in water crying, I thirst. What we want, what we're agitating for, what we're rushing towards, really, is what we have already. Rushing towards this very moment. It's ironic. I think this has always been a problem for people, but it's especially a modern problem, and especially an American problem. This has been the case with America for quite a while. Back when de Tocqueville was in this country, just after the Revolutionary War, I believe, he commented on the American character and our all the qualities we had back then we have now. We've just amped them up a little more. So this is a little selection from Henry Miller. It's from a novel, The Colossus of Marussi. It says, the moment I stepped on the American boat, which was to take me to New York, I felt I was in another world. I was among the go-getters again. among the restless souls who, not knowing how to live their own life, wish to change the world for everybody. So many people are struck by that. And of course, New York City is kind of the epitome of that. It's exhilarating in a way to be in New York. People are moving, it's alive, but they're missing something. We don't have to miss it. You can be moving quickly. You can be responding in an instant and still be present. But it's a skill that doesn't come naturally. And for most of us, our culture inculcates something totally different. Joko Beck said, "There is a foundation for our lives, a place on which, in which our life rests. That place is nothing but the present moment, as we see, hear, experience what is. If we do not return to that place, we live our lives out of our heads. We blame others, we complain, we feel sorry for ourselves. All of these symptoms show that we're stuck in our thoughts. We're out of touch with the open space that is always right there." Just one more quote. Again from Henry Miller. This is his prescription: "To be silent the whole day long. See no newspaper, hear no radio, listen to no gossip, be thoroughly and completely lazy, thoroughly and completely indifferent to the fate of the world, is the finest medicine a man can give himself." You would think that we would get that medicine when we do Zazen. And we can. Often we do. But we bring into our practice all the compulsion, all the grasping, all the rushing to the resolution that screws up the whole rest of our lives. It takes a lot of dedication to let that stuff go. It takes noticing what we're doing. People don't realize how tied up they are in their thoughts. You can't stop thoughts from coming into the mind. For the umpteenth time, I'll quote Roshi and say, the brain is an organ that secretes thoughts. But we do have the wherewithal to decide not to chase them. Let them come and let them go. It's the skill that we learn in Zazen. And hopefully, those of us who've been practicing for some time have learned to slow down a bit. But just speaking for myself, this is unfinished business. There is more to do. So easy to get hooked. So easy to fall into the old patterns. It's really worth taking a little time and thinking about it. Looking at it. When I was researching this, looking for material, I came across a book by Eknath Iswaran. I believe he did a translation of the Dhammapada that I've used in the past. He came to America and he wrote a book called Take Your Time, The Wisdom of Slowing Down. Of course, I found this book at the last minute, so I downloaded it as a Kindle. Hopefully I won't do anything to make the the iPad talk to us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, his wife writes an introduction to the book. And just to go over a little of this again, she says, in this book, he describes the shock he felt on arriving in New York and seeing firsthand the pace at which Americans were moving, even then. Today, 1959 feels leisurely. The first day, he says, he decided never to get caught up in this kind of rat race. And not only that, but to help everyone around him slow down too. At that point, he was still putting the finishing touches on his 8-point program. This was a program to help people slow down. Two of the points suddenly jumped in importance, slowing down and one-pointed attention, his term for doing one thing at a time with an undivided mind. At first, I don't think anyone listening to him understood why a spiritual teacher should place so much emphasis on anything so commonplace. Today it's clear that he was seeing what lay in store for our society if the pressures to hurry were not reduced. And we all know, of course, that they've amped up dramatically. She says, and this was interesting to me, the 70s brought the first signs of an adverse effect on health. And then she quotes the title of the book, Type A Behavior and Your Heart, called attention to what doctors Ray H. Rosenman and Meyer Friedman called, quote, hurry sickness, a syndrome of time-driven behavior that they felt was closely associated with heart disease. Iswaran was especially pleased with their description, their description included what they called polyphasic thinking, not just trying to do too many things in too little time, but trying to think about several things at once. At last, he felt clinicians were looking at the role played by the mind. Type A behavior syndrome is still debated by researchers, but Dr. Friedman's description fits so perfectly that it captured popular attention. Type A behavior, he explained, is above all a continuous struggle to accomplish more and more things in less and less time, frequently in the face of opposition, real or imagined, from other persons. Type A's are driven by an aggressive need to compete, and they keep score with anything that can be counted. How many facts can they know? How much work can they do in an hour? How many things can they do at once? A little farther on, she says, I saw close friends who had undergone heart surgery transform their lives through Dr. Friedman's clinical program, which taught type A's how to become type B's. I'm glad I'm a beta. Or in Iswaran's language, how to slow down, learn to be more patient, and find meaning, love, and rich relationships in lives impoverished by years of hard driving in the fast lane. I remember hearing about type A behavior. It was quite a thing for a while. You don't hear so much anymore. And one of the recommendations was to force yourself to drive when you're on the freeway, the thruway, to drive in the right lane. Don't get out of the right lane. Just go at whatever pace people do. And that's a really interesting experiment, which I didn't care for. But I think I recommend it. What I thought was, well, I'll stay relaxed and I'll drive in the fast lane. Which you can do. You can do. But it's amazing how just making yourself go a little more slowly, even if it feels awkward or you resist, can change the tone. It's worth considering. There's so many things that have an effect on the mind. Number one, of course, how we use the mind. How much we're wrapped up in our thinking. How much that thinking is goal-oriented when it doesn't need to be. How much of it is comparing ourselves with others, worrying about the opinions of others, introjecting all the demands of society. It's no wonder we're messed up. Can't do too much with this book, but I want to read just a little story that he tells. Which makes the case of slowing down just for other people's sake. This little section has a headline. It says, "Just one person slowing down helps everyone around to relax too." And he says, "During my first Christmas in California, I went to the post office to send a package to my mother in India." Ishwaran was born in India, and actually his models for learning to slow down were his grandmother and Mahatma Gandhi. In that order. I went to the post office to send a package. As I neared the sedate old building, erected in a time when the pace of life was slower, I noticed cars double parked and people darting up and down the broad granite steps. Inside was a scene of frustration, exasperation, and sometimes outright anger. Crowd or no crowd, I needed to mail my package. I joined a long queue and stood patiently watching the scene around me. Everyone was giving unintended lessons on how to put yourself under pressure. One fellow in front of me was bouncing up and down as if he were on a pogo stick. He was in such a hurry that he just had to release his nervous energy somehow, and with people pressing you in front and behind, the only direction possible is up. You ever noticed at a traffic light, as you sit waiting for the light to turn green, how often you see little cars sort of move forward a little bit and then put the brakes back on? Just so hard for people just to wait. The light will turn green, and then there's a long pedal you can step on, and your car will go. It goes on, "The gentleman in back of me was also in a hurry, and he was expending his nervous energy by blowing hot air down my neck. Well, I thought, Christmas is the time for expressions of goodwill, so I turned around. 'Take my place,' I told him. 'I'm not in a hurry.' He was so distracted that he didn't hear me. He just said brusquely, 'What?' 'Take my place,' I repeated. 'I have time. I'm in no hurry at all.' He stared, and then he began to relax. I felt the atmosphere around us begin to change. He apologized for being in such a hurry and mumbled something about being double parked. I wanted to ask, 'Why do you double park?' But I thought better of it." Slowly, the queue moved forward. The young woman at the counter was probably a college student filling in for the holidays, and she was making mistake after mistake, giving the wrong stamps, giving the wrong change, while people complained and corrected her. I could see that she was getting more and more upset, and the more upset she got, the more mistakes she made, and the longer each transaction took. All because everybody was in a hurry. If the scene had ever had any Christmas cheer, it was evaporating rapidly. I'm fond of students. I was a professor for many years. So when it came my turn at the window, I said, 'I'm from India. Take your time.' She looked as if she couldn't believe it, but she smiled and relaxed, and she gave me the right change and the right stamps too. I thanked her and wished her a Merry Christmas. As I walked out, I noticed that the man behind me returned her smile. The whole room had relaxed a little. I even heard a ripple of laughter from the end of the queue. Pressure is contagious, but so is goodwill. Just one person slowing down, one person not putting others under pressure, helps everybody else to relax too. To paraphrase the Buddha, we learn to do this by doing it. We learn to slow down by trying to slow down." So we're driven by our thoughts. We're driven by our identification with our thoughts. Everything is mediated by thoughts, and therefore we're not seeing directly. thing and the thought are two totally different categories. This is the slogan of Zen from the very, very beginning, a teaching beyond words and concepts, pointing directly at the mind. We could say pointing directly at reality, pointing directly at this moment. It's not just thoughts, but emotions, fear, anxiety, anger. Everything is driven by our automatic acceptance of whatever the small mind, the calculating mind, the grasping mind throws up. Why believe what you think? If you reflect for even a moment, you realize you don't think anything because you decided to think it. Thought comes into the mind and then you buy into it. Can't really wake up to this until we see what's going on. And that's what practice is good for. Just did a workshop, online workshop yesterday, and always tell people, first time you ever sit, you're going to be astounded by the force of your thought stream. It's daunting. A lot of people dip their toe in and they never come back. It's so overwhelming, seems so impossible. Then we trot out the snow globe. We've all seen the snow globe, right? Shake it up, and all those flakes represent everything swirling in your mind. All you have to do is put it on the table and leave it alone. We try to do everything by means of our thoughts. It's been compared. It's been compared to somebody who loses their keys. They drop them in the shadows somewhere, and a man comes along, sees the poor guy looking for them. he says, "Well, did you drop them around here?" And he said, "No, but the light's better here." As he paws around underneath a street lamp. Everything is murky for us outside of our thoughts. That's the world we're living in. And it's such a small sliver of reality. Yasutani Roshi used to hold up a ballpoint pen and he'd say, if this pen represents reality, then the thinking mind is the tip of the ball at the end of the pen. So step one is getting some distance from that grasping, thinking, calculating mind. Realizing that that's not who we are. And Anthony DeMello, our constant companion, good friend, has something to say about that. He says, watch everything inside of you and outside. And when there is something happening to you, see it as if it were happening to someone else, with no comment, no judgment, no attitude, no interference, no attempt to change, only to understand. This is the approach to practice, only to understand, only to see. He says, as you do this, you'll begin to realize that increasingly you are disidentifying from me. From our idea of ourselves. Saint Teresa of Avila says that toward the end of her life, God gave her an extraordinary grace. She doesn't use this modern expression, of course, but what it really boils down to is disidentifying from herself. If someone else has cancer and I don't know the person, I'm not all that affected. If I had love and sensitivity, I'd help. But I'm not emotionally affected. If you have to take an examination, I'm not all that affected. I can be quite philosophical about it and say, well, why don't you, the more you worry about it, the worse it'll get. Why don't you just take a good break instead of studying? But when it's my turn to have an examination, well, that's something else, isn't it? The reason is that I've identified with me, with my family, my country, my possessions, my body, me. How would it be if God gave me grace not to call these things mine? I'd be detached. I'd be disidentified. That's what it means to lose the self, to deny the self, to die to the self. It's always so confirming and heartening when we begin to react differently in situations that used to trigger us. When we find we're no longer as prickly, no longer as quick to see insults or disrespect. It really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what other people think. The more we disidentify, the more we live out of no self, the freer we are, the more joy we can find, the more equanimity, the less we find ourselves compulsively rushing. The more clearly we see other people. It's another section from DeMello. He says, the important thing is not to know who I is, I in quotation marks, or what I is. You'll never succeed. There are no words for it. The important thing is to drop the labels. As the Japanese Zen masters say, don't seek the truth, just drop your opinions. Drop your theories. Don't seek the truth. Truth isn't something you search for. If you stop being opinionated, you would know. Something similar happens here. If you drop your labels, you would know. What do I mean by labels? Every label you can conceive of, except perhaps that of human being. I am a human being. Fair enough. Doesn't say very much. But when you say, I am successful, that's crazy. Success is not part of the I. Success is something that comes and goes. It could be here today and gone tomorrow. That's not I. When you said I was a success, you were in error. You were plunged into darkness. You identified yourself with success. The same thing when you said I'm a failure, a lawyer, a businessman. You know what's going to happen to you if you identify yourself with those things. You're going to cling to them. You're going to be worried that they may fall apart. And that's where your suffering comes in. That's what I meant earlier when I said to you, if you're suffering, you're asleep. It's a hard thing for people to accept. Sometimes it's easier to accept it if you understand it as there's simple suffering, and then there's the suffering that we pile on top. It's the second one that causes all the problems. It says, do you want a sign that you're asleep? Here it is. You're suffering. Suffering is a sign that you're out of touch with the truth. Suffering is given to you that you might open your eyes to the truth, that you might understand that there is falsehood somewhere, just as physical pain is given to you so you will understand there's a disease or illness somewhere. Suffering points out that there is falsehood somewhere. It's a little like something that Byron Katie says. Interesting woman. Can't really go into everything about her, but she said that feeling of dis-ease, anxiety, whatever it is like a compassionate alarm clock telling you you're lost in the dream. It's the dream of what's not important, of what's not real. It's a dream that doesn't stop altogether just because we have some insight. It's our karma. It's the world we live in. Always going to find ourselves getting tripped up. But with practice, over time, we recover so much more quickly. And we know what's going on when we start to feel anxiety. Say we're been asked to give a talk. We can't get out of it. It's not a problem. If we feel anxiety, that's just how we feel. We don't have to make it go away. That wanting to make it go away compounds it. Acceptance can do so much to help ourselves and to help other people. When you don't paper everything over with your ideas, you can see people more clearly. It's so easy to think you're a person of goodwill and nevertheless say and do things that are hurtful to others. See it in all kinds of situations. So one of the almost intractable problems with our inherent bias, racist bias against people who are different in one way or another. When you're only half looking, you just put people into a category, and even when you're friendly, that sweetness is tinged with a little disregard. You haven't really taken them in. You're not truly intimate. Just to swallow everything is the way forward. Valuing this moment, whoever you're talking with, whoever you're with, is the most important person in the world. How many of us can do that? So hard. Going to finish up by reading from Eckhart Tolle. I've never read from him before. I know Roshi gave a teisho on him once. He wrote the book that you may have heard of, The Power of Now. According to the cover, over 2 million copies sold. Pretty popular guy all over YouTube. Very strange man. He's like a gnome. It actually reminds me of when I first met Philip Kaplow. I came in expecting this, you know, Zen samurai, and here was a guy in a cardigan sweater, little guy, just so still. What the heck is this? So yeah, Eckhart Tolle has that in spades. So his thing is the now. That's how it came to him. That's how his awakening happened. Suddenly realized it's here, it's now. Sometimes people say here and now. For him, it's just the now. The problem with that, of course, is then everybody starts glibly talking about the now and it becomes another thing. But underneath, there's some no thing there that's extremely significant. He says, since ancient times, spiritual masters of all traditions have pointed to the now as the key to the spiritual dimension. Despite this, it seems to have remained a secret. It is certainly not taught in churches and temples. If you go to a church, you may hear readings from the Gospels, such as, take no thought for the morrow will take thought of the things of itself. Or, nobody who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. Or you might hear the passage about the beautiful flowers that are not anxious about tomorrow, but live with ease in the timeless now and are provided for abundantly by God. The depth and radical nature of these teachings are not recognized. No one seems to realize that they are meant to be lived and to bring about a profound inner transformation. It's a problem with every religion. It becomes rote. It's the reason why each of us have to make it new for ourselves. Can't do Zen practice to please someone else. He says here, the great Zen master Rinzai, in order to take his students' attention away from time, would often raise his finger slowly and ask, "What at this moment is lacking?" A powerful question that does not require an answer on the level of the mind, that is, the thinking mind. It's designed to take your attention deeply into the now. I think of what Zen Master Dogen said. If you're unable to find the truth right where you are, where else do you expect to find it? We're caught up in time, in our idea of time. And Tola makes a good distinction between what he calls psychological time and clock time. Everybody needs to pay attention to clock time because you have to be at the center at 8:30, by 8:30 on a Sunday. So there's got to be a little time in your life, right? But that other, what's called psychological time, that feeling of pressure, racing to get to the next thing, that's the big problem. I read in Ishwaran that Gandhi, who slowly and deliberately and took his time, also carried a watch, which he pinned to his simple garment. And if anybody came to a meeting late, he would hold it up and show it to them. So we have the responsibility to be on time, but not to be wrapped up in it. He says, Eckhart Tolle says, learn to use time in the practical aspects of your life. We may call this clock time. But immediately return to present moment awareness when those practical matters have been dealt with. In this way, there will be no buildup of psychological time, which is identification with the past and continuous compulsive projection into the future. Clock time is not just making an appointment or planning a trip. It includes learning from the past so we don't repeat the same mistakes over and over, setting goals and working toward them, predicting the future by means of patterns and laws, physical, mathematical, and so on. Learn from the past and taking appropriate action on the basis of our predictions. But even here, within the sphere of practical living, where we can do without reference to past and future, the present moment remains the essential factor. Any lesson from the past becomes relevant and is applied now. Any planning as well, working toward achieving a particular goal, is done now. The enlightened person's main focus of attention is always the now, but they are still peripherally aware of time. In other words, they continue to use clock time, but are free of psychological time. As an example, if you made a mistake in the past and learned from it now, you're using clock time. On the other hand, if you dwell on it mentally and self-criticism, remorse, or guilt come up, then you're making the mistake into me and mine. You make it part of your sense of self, and it has become psychological time, which is always linked to a false sense of identity. Non-forgiveness necessarily implies a heavy burden of psychological time. It's liberating to realize that we can forgive ourselves, can make mistakes, and then they just pass. Even if you don't forgive yourself, it's going to pass, unless it's really a big one that you're going to beat yourself up about for the rest of your life. they pass more quickly when you don't get stuck. When you're willing to give yourself a break just as you would give anyone else a break. In the book somewhere, he points out that everything that happens to us, this is patently, obviously true, everything that happens to us happens now. Everything that happened to you in the past happened now. And everything that's going to happen to you in the future happens now, will happen now. We're always there. It's like, it reminds me of something writer Doctorow talked about, driving across the country at night. You can only see by your headlights. You can go 3,000 miles from one coast to the other just looking at what's in front of you. If you live your life that way, it's different. You're present for all of it. You're there for the whole trip. One place where it really, really helps is in Sesshin. You can stay present, not catastrophize, not regret, not look ahead, not look back. Just do what's in front of you. Everything simplifies. You find yourself slowing down. You find space. And ultimately, you find joy. Going to read a poem that finish with a poem I've read before. It's by Mary Oliver and entitled The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, was moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, was gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me what it is you plan to do with your one wild and precious life. Okay. Stop here and recite the four vows.